Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. A total of 50 Taliban and alleged Al-Qaeda prisoners now sit in chain-link cells at the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo Bay. Since last Thursday, two plane loads of hooded, shackled prisoners have been sent to the remote Cuban facility. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says more groups will be flown in every day or two now. Rumsfeld says the prisoners are key sources of information for the United States in investigating Al-Qaeda and its lethal terrorist threat. Last week, before the prisoners took up their new lodgings, the military allowed a group of reporters to tour the detention center. Angus McSwan, Caribbean Bureau Chief for Reuters, was with that group. I spoke to him today from Miami. I asked him what is at the heart of a brewing international controversy over the conditions and status of the prisoners.
Well, I think the heart of the controversy is on two levels. One is the conditions in which they're being kept, and then secondly, their legal status and what rights, if any, they're entitled to.
What is their status at this point?
Well, it's still a matter of discussion. As far as the U.S. is concerned, they're unlawful combatants and not prisoners of war. Of course, prisoner of war status would mean that they would be entitled to the rights of the Geneva Convention. But I understand that today in Geneva, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, has said that as far as she and international organizations are concerned, they are in fact prisoners of war.
You've been to Guantanamo. Are there some of the rights under the Geneva Convention that are clearly being denied these prisoners?
Well, that would be hard to say unless you were sort of an expert on these matters. And that, as I say, that is being thrashed out right now.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. military says that they will respect international laws, although they also say they're not obliged to. And they also insist that they are being treated humanely, although the intention of their incarceration is not to make them comfortable in any way.
Angus McSwan, when were you in Guantanamo?
I was in Guantanamo last week. I saw Camp X-Ray, as the actual prison compound is known, on Wednesday before the prisoners arrived. And I did witness the prisoner arrival, although we weren't permitted to see the camp again after it had its residence.
So you saw the facilities. Can you describe them to us?
Yes, the camp, it's called Camp X-Ray, as I mentioned, and it's in a fairly remote part of the base, in a sort of a patch of scrubland surrounded by a few hillocks. And from the outside, its prison compound looks rather like anybody who's seen POW MIA movies from Vietnam would be familiar with. A couple of barbed wire fences with razor wire on top, watchtowers with machine guns inside. And then inside, which I think this is the main point of controversy, are the actual cells which the prisoners or detainees will be held in individually.
And what do those cells look like? What's the point of contention?
They are basically exposed to the elements. They have a wooden roof and a concrete floor, but the walls are made of chain-link wire, which exposes them to any bad weather and certainly to all the heat down there and the mosquitoes, which are quite thick, I can assure you.
So does it look like a facility intended to cause discomfort to its occupants?
I would only say I don't think they were intended to enjoy themselves when they were there. I think I should also point out that the military says that this is a temporary camp. They are building more permanent facilities, but that will take several weeks at least. So the people who arrived there this week and last week, I think we're up to 80 as of this afternoon. They'll be there for several weeks.
So when these facilities are described as cages, that's because it's chain link fence that's being used, I guess is what people are referring to.
Yeah, the camp warden, Colonel Terry Carrico, it was put to him that these were like dog kennels. He said he wouldn't call them that, but he'd call them outdoor cells. And so I think for the layman, a cage is a pretty accurate description.
Were you close enough to see the prisoners' condition when they arrived in Guantanamo?
No, we weren't. We were about 400 yards away, and we did see them come off the plane. It was a bit difficult to discern exactly in what shape they were in. Some of them did appear to stumble. Whether this was because they were resisting or because they were disorientated and weak after a fairly long and difficult mm-hmm. journey, mm-hmm. I really couldn't say.
And inside the cells, what are the facilities within each cell for the prisoner?
They each have a mat, and on top of that, they'll have two towels, so we were told. and the towels can be used. One of them can be used as a prayer mat, and the other for just general bathroom purposes. We were told that they wouldn't be given a blanket, so they would have to make do with what they had there. And they were also given a comfort kit, as it was described, which included some small food items, a toothbrush, soap, and other wash gear.
Is there some kind of toilet facility in each cell?
Yes. We were told they would have a toilet facility, though they didn't explain exactly what that was. And also they would be taken out for other sort of bathroom and toilet requirements at certain times during the day.
Do the facilities continue to be open to inspection by the International Red Cross, the press, or others?
The press, certainly not at this point. For the Red Cross, that's a matter of discussion right now. They have been told, the Red Cross has been told, that they can visit and will get access to the detainees, but that certainly hasn't happened yet. I understand it might be happening in the next few days.
How many prisoners does it appear that this facility could handle?
At the moment, it's ready for about 100. It's still being built, and the camp commander said it should be able to hold about 200 by the time they're finished with it.
I know this is wholly subjective, but did the facilities look to you, under the circumstances, humane?
I think what I would say is that if American soldiers have been held in those conditions in Afghanistan or anywhere else for that matter, the American public would probably be fairly upset about it.
Angus McSwan is Caribbean Bureau Chief for Reuters.
I do not feel even the slightest concern about their treatment. They are being treated vastly better than they treated anybody else over the last several years, and vastly better than was their circumstance when they were found.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld may not have the slightest concern for the treatment of the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, but do you? Pressure is mounting from the international community for the U.S. military to improve the treatment of its prisoners and to clarify their legal status. Today, U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson called on the U.S. to officially recognize the detainees as prisoners of war, with all the rights accorded to POWs under international convention. So far, the U.S. has walked a tightrope in its classification of the prisoners. Not quite prisoners of war, Washington says, not quite entitled to certain rights. What rights should these prisoners have in this new type of war? And who's watching out for them? Do traditional rules like the Geneva Convention apply? Or does the U.S. have a right to hold the prisoners beyond the purview of international oversight? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Our guest tonight is Stephen Neff. Stephen Neff is Senior Lecturer in International Law at the University of Edinburgh Law School in Scotland. He's written many articles on international human rights law. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Neff.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
Yes, I'm pleased to be here.
Stephen Neff, what's going on here? Do we just have a failure to communicate? Washington seems as though it's saying to the world, look, we just don't give a damn about how they're treated. They've got they're being fed, and there's a roof over their head, and beyond that, this is the backbone of a terrorist organization that hit us and hurt us badly. On the other side, we see increasingly from Europe and the UN people saying, what about international law? What's at the heart of this controversy?
Well, the United States is determined to have as much flexibility as it can in dealing with the situation and is determined to have as little as possible in the way of, shall we say, second-guessing by courts as to what it does. And that's why its program is carefully maintained to keep these people at arm's length from the law. There are then the technical questions of whether or not they are entitled to prisoner of war status. And the United States insists that as a matter of law that they are not, though as a matter of practice or as a matter of grace, the United States will treat them humanely, seems to be the American position.
Dig into that for us, Stephen Neff. How is the United States classifying these prisoners right now, and what does that classification suggest for their physical treatment and for their judicial treatment?
Well, if somebody is classed as a prisoner of war, that has a number of implications. What it means, for one thing, is that the persons are not accused of any criminal activity or wrongdoing. All that you have the right to do to a prisoner of war, basically, is to sequester them from the conflict. You do not have a right to punish them, because by being lawful combatants, they have, by definition, done nothing wrong.
But the U.S. is not classifying them as prisoners of war, is it? What classification is it giving them?
It's considering them to be unlawful belligerents or unlawful combatants, meaning that they don't qualify under the various criteria for prisoners of war, And what that means, in effect, is that they are basically just ordinary criminals.
What's the distinction between a POW and an unlawful combatant materially?
There are several distinctions. If one is not an official prisoner of war, then one doesn't have a legal right to visitations by or supervision by the International Committee of the Red Cross. For example, and as I say, one can the captor can proceed with criminal proceedings against the persons.
Mm-hmm. So, on the other hand, we hear that the International Red Cross will soon be permitted to visit these prisoners. So that is not being they're not being cut off from that.
Apparently not. The United States' position, I think, is that they are being allowed access to the Red Cross by permission of the United States or as an act of grace, but not as a matter of legal right.
And what's the legal framework in which the United States is looking at this that permits, that would permit them to keep these prisoners beyond the purview of international oversight?
Well, it has to do with the official definition of what is a combatant. And this goes back to the Hague Rules of 1907, which are still in force and still govern this. And basically, there are two ways to be a lawful combatant. One is that you can be a member of the regular armed forces of a country, and then you have an automatic right to mm-hmm. be treated as a prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. And it's the American position, apparently, that these people are not lawful regular members of the Afghanistan armed forces. Now, whether any given person is or isn't is a matter for individual decision on each individual person's own circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I can't say as a blanket matter whether that proposition is correct or not.
The International Red Cross has said in the last day or two that they would consider the Taliban soldiers detained to be properly considered POWs. And they say they're still considering the proper status of the Al-Qaeda fighters.
Yes, the position there would be that those who are Taliban persons were actually members of the regular armed forces of the state of Afghanistan, because the Taliban was the effective government of Afghanistan, and that's the reason for that position. Mm-hmm. Now, as to somebody who's not a regular member of the armed forces, there is still a possibility of prisoner of war treatment, but only provided that certain criteria are met. And these include, for example, the wearing of a distinctive sign visible at a distance, mm-hmm. not necessarily a uniform specifically, but a distinctive sign is mm-hmm. what the Hague Rules require. And also the persons must obey the laws of war themselves, and they must carry their arms openly. And the United States maintains that that these persons do not meet those criteria.
Does that seem reasonable to you from the coverage of Al-Qaeda's warring style that you saw?
Well, it does in a general way, but it depends on the activities of each person. For example, think about those involved in the actual September 11th attacks. If you regard that as an act of war, and that's actually very questionable, but if you regard it as an act of warfare, then it is the most egregious and flagrant violation of the laws of war. So obviously people who are unwilling to observe the laws of war would mm-hmm. not be entitled to prisoner of war status. But I think it's also, one should bear in mind that most of those who are held probably were not involved in the actual attack on the buildings. Mm-hmm. And so that they are being held by virtue of the fact that they are just members of Al-Qaeda. So it's not so clear that they would be unwilling or unable to observe the laws of war. Now, whether they wore distinctive signs, I'm not sure about mm-hmm. that. Whether they had certain colors of turbans or whatever that marked them out as military
figures, fighting force
mm-hmm. or carried arms openly. I don't know enough about the individual situation.
There are a lot of things that are not so clear.
Person by person.
Mm, a lot of things that are not so clear here, Stephen Neff. I mean, you say that 9/11 was very questionable that that's an act of war, and yet it's been called an act of war, and a war on terrorism has been called in response to it.
Yes, that is one of the interesting things about this from the legal standpoint, is that there are two ways broadly that one could react to that kind of situation. One is
Stephen Neff, hold that thought. We've got to take a quick break. We'll come right back and get those two ways. You can join this conversation tonight by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Are you comfortable with U.S. treatment of the prisoners in Guantanamo? Is it appropriate, humane, principled, wrong, or just right? You can view a photo gallery of Camp X-Ray at our website. Go to WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the status, both physical and legal, of the prisoners now held in Guantanamo at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. What do you think? What precedent is being set here, one that will deter terrorism or one that might come back one day to haunt U.S. POWs? Is the U.S. irresponsibly flouting international convention, or is it doing just what it has to do? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined from Edinburgh, Scotland, by Stephen Neff. He's a senior lecturer in international law at the University of Edinburgh School of Law. He's written many articles on international human rights law. Stephen Neff, today, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said that, quote, the president is satisfied that they, the prisoners, are being treated as Americans would want people to be treated. Is that an adequate standard?
Well, the standard which is applicable in the absence of prisoner of war status is the general standards set by international human rights law, which are not very specific, it must be said here, but they require humane treatment. And that there are differences of opinion about what is and isn't humane. President Bush's military order, by the way, setting up the providing for the internment and the military commissions, does expressly state that the detainees are to be treated humanely.
Mm-hmm.
But there can be, of course, a variety of opinions as to whether the present conditions that we've had described really qualify as humane.
Are there circumstances under international law in which human rights standards can be put aside, Stephen F.?
Yes. International human rights law, the principal UN covenant on the subject, does allow derogation from certain human rights standards, not all of them, but certain ones. And it allows derogation particularly and most relevantly from rules about holding people in detention and fairness of trials and so forth. But these derogations are allowed, as the covenant puts it, in cases of emergency which threaten the life of the nation.
Is that the situation here, formally?
Well, that isn't the turn of phrase that President Bush used in declaring a state of emergency, but he nevertheless did declare an emergency formally and officially very shortly after the 11 September attacks.
That somehow flew by me. Is that a significant step in law?
From the standpoint of international human rights law, it is, because it's generally held that the states themselves have a well-nigh unfettered right to determine whether or not an emergency exists. If an emergency does exist, then certain human rights standards can be derogated from, although only to the extent strictly necessary to deal with the emergency.
Stephen Neff, I want to step back from the details of the legalese for a moment. You've looked a lot in international human rights. What's your gut feeling? What does your thinking tell you about what's going on here? Is this an appropriate way of handling these prisoners, given the outrageous, murderous terrorist attack on 9/11? Or is there some precedent that's being set here that in fact may make the road ahead more difficult for the United States and other nations?
Well, I'm not sure that it will make it more difficult for the United States in the future. There is some precedent in the United States' own past for treating unlawful belligerents in this kind of way. But I think the best way of putting it is to say that we are on legally largely uncharted ground here, is that we don't have a very good precedent for making war in a military sense against a non-state entity, such as a terrorist network. And sometimes the United States treats this as if it were a war with fully-fledged belligerency and the laws of war applying, and sometimes it's treating it as a mere criminal matter. And the United States kind of seems to oscillate between the two, picking whichever approach is most appropriate for its policies. So I'm afraid one can't really give a very definite answer at this stage as to whether this is flatly legal or illegal. The law here is in a state of continuous evolution.
We're kind of making it up as we go along, though for a long time the Geneva Convention has been the sort of bedrock expectation of treatment of prisoners in combat. And here that seems to be going away.
Well, the United States maintains that these people are not lawful combatants, and hence they are not entitled to treatment under the Geneva Conventions.
Stephen Neff, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Is U.S. treatment of these prisoners promoting justice, or, as some are now claiming, a new kind of barbarism? Should U.S. treatment of prisoners answer to any oversight, particularly after the kind of crime we saw on 9/11. Rick is on the line. Welcome, Rick. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have sort of a twofold question. The first one is the empirical evidence we have is that when we allow these people to congregate together in confinement, like at Mazar-e Sharif, that they will revolt and they will
and did
their campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And my second comment is, how do you deal with the status of someone who basically, this is a transnational group, and they believe they're taking their orders basically directly from God?
Yeah, that's a nation state on a different order.
Exactly.
Rick, thanks for your call. Stephen Neff, Rick points out it is a transnational group. It's not just a traditional nation state party to this war. And it has proven in Mazar-e Sharif and in other places that, given a chance, these are men who are willing to take desperate steps, even suicidal steps, to resist their imprisonment. Does that all change the way that the U.S. looks at this, that the world looks at this?
Well, that is to be taken into account. When holding people as detainees, obviously one is not legally required to do so in a way that places the detainers in actual danger of literally their lives, so that one has to apply the standards in a flexible and reasonable fashion. And the United States maintains that it is doing that.
But when Donald Rumsfeld says they are being treated vastly better than they treated anybody else, that seems kind of like a dive for the lowest common denominator here. I mean, does the U.S. want to set its policy in comparison to how Al-Qaeda treated people?
Well, I think a charitable way of referring to Mr. Rumsfeld's statement is that there was some very unfortunate phraseology used there. I think he seems to be presupposing the guilt of these people, and his statement did have an air of vindictiveness about it, which I think is unfortunate.
Mary Robinson, UN High Commissioner, in her statement today pointed out that prisoners of war are entitled to a presumption of innocence. You don't think that's being granted here?
Well, bear in mind that prisoners of war, if they are truly prisoners of war, are not accused of any criminal offense at all, and so presumption of innocence doesn't enter in. It's persons who are accused of crimes who are entitled to presumption of innocence. And incidentally, I should note that presumption of innocence is included in the things that can be derogated from in a state of emergency.
In fairness to Mary Robinson, she's saying in the case of any possible trials that would ensue, that presumption should be there.
Yes. Now, whether that will be there fully or not is difficult to say because of the President Bush's proclamation of an emergency would in principle allow derogation from that. But I think that looking at the order that he has put through, that this will be a more or less ordinary trial, and I think that there would be presumptions of innocence if trials were to take place. I'm not convinced, incidentally, that trials will take place.
You think it may just be interrogation and then what?
Interrogation and perhaps indefinite detention, and I think that's one of the important reasons that they're being held in Guantanamo, so that they will be outside the reach of American courts and habeas corpus process.
Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm traveling, so I hope my signal sticks. I'm a Christian pastor. I'm the pastor of a United Church of Christ church in Vermont.
All right.
And it strikes me that the United States, as you just said, should not be taking the lowest common denominator on the moral ground. with this one, that these individuals, regardless of their behavior, and yes, what happened in September was a horrible thing, but that we ought to be taking, as a government, the moral high ground on this and treating these individuals with all due respect. Now, I understand that there's lots of your listeners who are going to be screaming at their radios right now.
Well, what do we gain from that, Jim?
We gain an opportunity as a nation to show that we are, in fact, not fanatics ourselves, that we're not acting in a retaliatory manner, in as, again, one of your speakers just said, that our defense minister, Rumsfeld, made some really unfortunate statements. He's continued to do so through all of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And really has showed a shocking disregard for human dignity, right? These are individual human beings.
Yes. Jim, your signal's a little shaky, but I think we've got your point. Stephen Neff, what about it? As you say, we're kind of making this up as we go along. We're in a new circumstance. We're on new legal ground here. How do you feel, as someone who's studied the law, about the kind of precedent on the ground that the U.S. is setting? Are you satisfied that there's a fair balance between, toughness and care here or not?
Well, it's difficult to say that without looking at each individual case, but I would like to say that I fully endorse the point of view that's just been expressed here. I think it is inappropriate for the United States to cut too many corners, as it were, on the human rights question, because I think one of the things that has most impressed the world around, and I mm-hmm. see it from being based outside the United States here, is that the United States has been on a moral high ground, that it reacted to the attacks with very impressive dignity, with national unity, and with a remarkable absence of vindictiveness and bitterness for its own sake. And I think that the world was very impressed by that. And I would hate to see that given up on relatively petty grounds.
The U.S. is now coming under some heat on just that front. Human Rights Watch said today that the campaign against terrorism is being used by other nations as an excuse to revoke civil liberties in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Uzbekistan, Russia. They also said that new restrictions in the United States on, like, the proposed military tribunals would compromise Washington's ability to criticize rights abuses in other nations in the future. So there is some concern growing on that front. Abby's on the line. Welcome, Abby. You're on the air.
Yes, I think I'm a federalist myself.
Okay.
And I think the frame of reference we're looking at this is wrong, and I'm surprised that none of your guests mentioned that.
Set us right, Abby. Set us right.
I'm sorry?
Set us right.
Yeah, well, set us right. The way we handle Milosevic, we should handle these people. We should create a world body and take care of all these problems.
You're saying send them to an international criminal court of some kind?
Well, of course. We're doing something illegal. We're contributing the future laws of jungle. And it's going to happen again. Everybody's going to be in the world is going to justify what they do by taking law under their own hands. So we should be careful if we want to create a model for the future of the lawful world. We should abide by our future futuristic benign factors.
But Abby, the blow against the United States was so egregious. If prisoners, once charged with some kind of crime, are sent off to an international criminal court and it takes years and years and it wends its way on and there's no sense of justice done more immediately, might that not contribute to more terrorism coming? What do you think?
None, because first of all, terrorists are punished. Yeah, it's like you're taking the fish out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And no longer, once you take the fish out of the water, it won't function as a fish. And so they are punished by being, how many people died so far? That's punishment. And what we're doing to Milosevic, it justified. And he's in prison somewhere, in jail somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He's not free.
Abby, we got it. Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. Stephen Neff. Abby says we risk taking this down to the law of the jungle level, and it should go to international criminal court. You've already pointed out that there are not charges yet, but there may be. If those come, do you see these men as appropriate subjects for international criminal court trial?
Yes, I think so. I would have no objection to that if it turned out that they were involved in the September 11th attacks. But I think the problem is that the particular people who are being held there probably didn't have anything to do with the actual attacks. Their problem is their offense, if one could call it that, is simply being members of Al-Qaeda. And the suspicion is, well, they may not have been involved in the September 11 attacks, but by Jove, they're probably planning something else.
So if they are then detained indefinitely, as you suggest they may be, perhaps even for life, is that just?
Well, I think there's where we're on the untrodden ground, because one might say, well, if we're not charging these people with anything, and if we don't accuse them of having been involved in the attacks, why don't we just let them go?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the United States' concern is that if you have a bunch of Al-Qaeda people that, even if they weren't involved in the actual attacks, they are equally murderous, and if you just let them go, they will set about plotting and murdering, and we will just be inviting another September 11 by allowing these people to leave. Mm-hmm. So I think that the United States is probably going to go for a preventive detention regime for these people.
We're on new ground here. In the Superman movies, they slap them in glass and send them to some different solar system. We don't have that option. Listeners, how should we handle the prisoners in Guantanamo? Charles is on the line. Welcome, Charles. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to flip this argument a bit and also ask Professor Neff to tell the American people, or at least to inform the American public, who in our government, which agency in our government is responsible for advising the government about international laws and regulations in Geneva Convention, because Rami doesn't get it. The Army obviously doesn't get it. Bush doesn't get it. And the other part of my question is, what about the Vienna Convention that are being, the clause in the Vienna Convention for those who are being held domestically, who have not had the chance to talk to members of their embassy? I forget the citation in the Vienna Convention. I hope Mr. Neff can at least enlighten American listeners.
We'll speak to those, and thanks for your call, Charles. We've just got a minute, Stephen Neff, but first of all, what about the Vienna Convention? What is that? How does it apply here?
I think he's referring to the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, which allows consular officials to have access to their nationals when they're imprisoned.
And in fairness, I think that the latest word is that there will be consular access.
Yes, I understand that to be so as well. Mm-hmm. The United States seems not to be in a desperate hurry on that ground, but I think that the United States is willing to allow that.
And what about the responsibility within the U.S. government? That's an interesting question. Is there some legal authority that is bound by law and constitution to deliver a sort of legal view on the treatment of these people, or does it fall between the cracks of justice and defense and who knows?
Well, the Justice, Defense, and State Departments all have legal advisors and legal staffs, of course.
But is there an obligation they may be held to? They may be sued for failing in.
Well, the United States as an entity, as a country, might find itself sued at some point or other. This is merely speculation, but it might be sued by some other country. For example, possibly a state of nationality of one of the people being held in Guantanamo.
Stephen Neff, we'll come back to that. We have to take a short break. Listeners, you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Are you comfortable with U.S. treatment of the prisoners in Guantanamo? Is it appropriate? Is it humane, principled, wrong, or just right? You can join the conversation online as well at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about how the U.S. is handling the tough customers, the prisoners in Guantanamo, the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo, Cuba right now. How does the U.S. keep the moral high ground and at the same time deal with alleged terrorists? Should we keep them detained forever without charge? Do we have to let them go at some point? Are we handling them fairly already? There's a growing noise in the world that says we're not. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Stephen Neff. He's senior lecturer in international law at the University of Edinburgh School of Law. Stephen Neff, you mentioned earlier U.S. precedents in U.S. history for I guess, unorthodox treatment of prisoners in times of emergency. Like what?
The major precedent occurred during World War II when some Germans who were out of uniform were landed, some saboteurs, and they were landed in New York and Florida with the intention of committing sabotage in war installations and the like. And they were held to be unlawful belligerents or unlawful combatants, and they were tried by military tribunal by presidential order. So that's the direct precedent for Mr. Bush's actions. And that case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court and was approved, although the precedent is not an exact one.
There was also something kind of out of the ordinary after Abraham Lincoln's assassination.
Yes, there was. It's an interesting point, somewhat more distantly, that the Lincoln assassins were tried by military commissions rather than by the ordinary civil courts.
On what grounds?
And it was implicitly on the ground that since Lincoln was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, that the assassination of Lincoln was basically an unlawful act of war, that is, an act of war in violation of the laws of war. And so military commissions were held. Military commissions are kind of a counterpart of courts-martial. If our own forces violate the laws of war, they will be tried by court-martial. But if the enemy side violates the laws of war, then persons will be tried by military commission.
Stephen Neff, we've got a line of callers who want to join us a mile long. Let's turn to them. Larry is on the line. Welcome, Larry. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
I appreciate you taking my call. I just want to say I believe there are a number of folks being caught up in the idea that these folks at Guantanamo Bay are actual criminals, so to speak. And the way they are criminals, more than anything else, they are, as our government has called them, illegal combatants. They are not uniformed soldiers of any army. We were not fighting the Afghan army. We were fighting members of a religious cult, a group.
Well, the Taliban was in charge, though, Larry. I mean, why wouldn't the Taliban soldiers at least be members of an army? They were the government, though they might be religious.
They were not actually a government. They were not elected by the people of Afghanistan. They took control by power and subversion. One of the things I wanted to say was, you know, and I get a little emotional about this.
That's all right. Let it go.
Our guys spent time in Vietnam in 4x4x4 cubes, so they couldn't lay down, stand up, or anything else.
Yes, sir.
We were urinated on, beat, and everything else. These guys, I'm sure, are not going to be treated that way. Now, are they going to be treated the same as a murderer in a jail here in the United States? No, probably not.
So, Larry, what do you think would be the right future for these prisoners?
I think they should be interrogated. These guys are not just your normal foot soldiers. These guys are supposed to be, as I understand
yes.
it, right-hand men, so to speak, the inner circle of the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda.
But after the interrogation, then what?
Well, if they are found guilty or found to be responsible for the attacks of September 11th, then they should be tried by probably, I'm assuming, an international court. If they are not found to be directly responsible for those attacks, then they should be, I'm assuming, I would say, in my mind, as bad as it sounds, someone's going to raise a devil, execute them.
But you're not crying for them now because it's hot down there and the mosquitoes can bite them.
No, sir. We're talking about the Caribbean. I'm in Pennsylvania. It's colder than the devil. I'm standing out on the porch getting some fresh air, and it's about 30 degrees here. Those guys are living a warmer life than I am right at the moment.
Larry, thanks for your call. Stephen Neff, not much sympathy there. What have you seen in other countries around the world that might give us pause about this? Can you cite examples of the way prisoners have been treated in other conflicts that describe an arc downward below the Geneva Convention standards that we might not want to be party to?
Well, the example just given of Vietnam was a good illustration. North Vietnam's position was that the United States captured air people were not entitled to treatment as prisoners of war. And that was on the grounds that they were war criminals. And
each and every one.
Yes, and the International Committee of the Red Cross objected to that and in a rare move objected publicly to it on the grounds that one cannot be considered a war criminal unless one has been actually tried and convicted. You can't simply be declared to be a war criminal and then treated as such.
And we all know how those men suffered, and we suffered with them from afar.
Yes.
Maribel is on the line. Welcome, Maribel. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
I'm terrified hearing how these men are going to be kept in Cuba. And precisely because the memory of the POWs in Vietnam mm-hmm. is not that far away.
Mm-hmm.
Neither are the prison camps and the Nazi camps. This may be a very complex international issue, but the few men that are being captured, if they're going to be thrown into some sort of legal limbo, why bother? You know, we're pummeling the country with unbelievable bomb force. What do we want to do with these rags that are called human now? You know, we want to really put them up like this, like dogs. My dogs live better than that. And I don't think there's anything written to deal with the aftermath of 9/11. But, you know, there are precedents. I work in the court system, mm-hmm. and I know people are just thrown in limbo and we forget about them, you know. Mm-hmm. So what kind of justification can there be?
But Maribel, you know, like we do, that in the Al-Qaeda headquarters in Kabul, there were plans for biological warfare, for nuclear warfare, that many of these guys are avowedly committed to a lifetime of fighting the United States.
Sure.
What if we let them go?
Well, we're giving them a better reason now. You know,
well, that's easy to say, but would you feel safer with these men loose?
There's not even a reason to capture them. I mean, they're going to bring them into Guantanamo and bury them there.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
know, they might as well execute them. We would never know about it. So what is the point? Are we going to make an example of the, you know, the pitiful 100 that we get? I have no satisfaction killing 100, you know.
Mm-hmm. Maribel, we take your point, and you're voting for the high road, and we hear your message loud and clear. We thank you for your call. Scott is on the line. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm on a cell phone, so I'll pose my question and then listen offline, if that's okay.
Bring it to us.
I just was looking for some clarification on the points of contention, essentially.
Okay.
You know, if we've officially declared these prisoners as non-combatants, then a lot of the rules of the Geneva Convention and so forth don't apply, as you've said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the Taliban concerned, if they're, you know, considered prisoners of war because they fought for the official government of that country,
mm-hmm.
and we're allowing the Red Cross to come in and do the inspections, then what are the other points of contention that make us not complying with the rules of the Geneva Convention?
We got it. Let's pin it down. Thank you for your call, Scott. Stephen F. Scott wants a little more specificity about where we may be at variance with international convention right now. In your view, what are those points?
Well, the major question is whether some of the Al-Qaeda people do or don't meet these various criteria for prisoner of war status, such as carrying arms openly and wearing a distinctive uniform. Now, assuming that they're not assuming for the moment that they are not prisoners of war and that they were not lawful combatants, that's the problem. What do we do with them? Many of them, it's not feasible to try for criminal offenses
mm-hmm.
because we have no evidence against them. They
mm-hmm.
probably weren't involved in the various attacks, so we can't try them and put them in jail like ordinary criminals. But there's much reluctance just to turn them loose and let them go because they are thought to be members of a horribly murderous group of people,
mm-hmm.
so that's not feasible. And so also there was the suggestion, well, why not just kill them rather than keep them there? Well, I'm afraid that just summary execution is not the American way.
That doesn't cut it. So there's a forward disposition problem here. I want to get one more call before the break. Richard is on the line. Welcome, Richard. Hello, Richard, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
I wanted to mention an example where another government just locked up a troublemaker for the rest of his life. This was Robert Sobukwe, who organized a political protest movement in South Africa in the 60s. The government massacred the protesters, and they arrested everyone leading it. And then they found he hadn't committed a crime. So they just passed a law saying they had to keep him in jail anyway. And he left. He spent, I think, most of the rest of his life on Robben Island, where they point out...
Richard, we just have a few seconds, but do you want to equate South African political protesters with members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban?
I want to equate preventive detention without a trial with detention without a trial. If we endorse this measure, which has been used in ways that are far more dangerous than, far more damaging in the world, caused millions of deaths, much worse than 9/11, if we do this ourselves... We can't fight against it. when it's done to people for other reasons, perhaps people who are mislabeled as terrorists who really are just protesters. And that's happening all around the world, too.
Richard, thanks very much for your call. Stephen Neff, we've just got a minute left. Give us your final thoughts here. What should we, as thoughtful people, be concerned about in this circumstance? What's on the line here?
I think that we should be concerned about primarily whether the treatment is actually humane for these people. And in a way, it doesn't matter too much whether they're prisoners of war officially or not. I think the position should be that whoever they are, they should be entitled to basic, humane, and decent treatment. And if they are tried, whether, again, it's by military commission or by ordinary courts, that the trial be full and fair. And President Bush's order, incidentally, does provide for that. But what we have to do is to see that those are not mere empty words just put out for propaganda purposes, that these standards are actually adhered to. And I think to revert to this point that was just made here, I think we do always have to be very, very careful that things like states of emergency and attacks and things that we are concerned about very justly are not used too liberally as excuses to cut back on the human rights of all of us, because the whole world will be a loser if that happens.
Stephen Neff, thank you very much for taking all these questions on the fly tonight. We thank you for joining us from Scotland.
Yes, thank you.
Stephen Neff is senior lecturer in international law at the University of Edinburgh School of Law. You can continue this conversation online at wbur.org. Click on Special Coverage. While Americans wrestle with questions about the fate of John Walker Lind, on the other side of the Pacific, Australians are questioning how one of their own citizens ended up fighting for the Taliban. David Hicks is an Australian citizen who first fought with the Kosovo Liberation Army and in December was captured by the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. Recently, Australian newspapers printed a poem written by Hicks that caused a sensation in the Australian media. Here, WBUR's Ian Doherty reads a poem by Australian Taliban David Hicks.
In this land of religion and war, to plunder the village, to tally the score. Then they let rip their chilling call, their mouths start to water, dribble and drool. They will ravage and savage and cut you down. Upon their heads wearing golden crowns, angry, hate, misery and sorrow, it keeps them going till tomorrow. Still they are proud, they have a reason. They're just caught up in the season. Ready to kill, ready to slaughter, even sacrifice their only daughter. So see the horses jump the ford, bow down now to your lord. Throughout the day and into the night, how could you ever stay from their sight? Hear the warriors roar, echoing through the land. It shall always reach the ears of the damned. Your oozing blood shall fill their bowls, while their hungry mouths devour the soul. Some people may call them truly insane, but in the end, only God's people will remain. Acting holy, their book says it's good. For normal man, this could never be understood. The Western world with its technology against the Islamic world with its mythology. So do not wait upon your brother. Do not have fear now for your mother. What to love, for this is best. Lest worldly burdens grow upon and fest. Lordly king on throne so high, to not obey is but to die. Mohammed's food you shall be fed. To disagree, so off with your head. The Muslim world will be the next to put this earth to its test, to see the rivers go roaring on. It is here that I do belong.
A poem written by Australian Taliban David Hicks, as read by WBUR's Ian Doherty. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
From Boston University, this